A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome. Today we're diving into something that, let's be honest, can sound pretty intimidating. The World Trade Organization, the WTO.
Yeah, it governs almost all global trade, but it often feels, you know, bureaucratic, maybe a bit distant, all those acronyms.
Exactly. And that's precisely why we need this deep dive. We're looking at it through the lens of Amrita Narlikar's work. She kind of peels back that dry economic layer.
She really does. She shows the WTO for what it is, a political battlefield, really, full of paradoxes. And right now, facing a pretty deep crisis.
So our mission today is to figure out why this institution, which often gets ignored, is actually super critical for global stability. Why should you care about the WTO's fate?
Well, because the whole system that's kept trade kind of stable for decades, that foundation for predictability in supply chains, global business, it's under real threat. You see it with rising protectionism, geopolitical tensions heating up.
Right. If the rules governing, what is it, 98% of global commerce.
Yeah.
If they break down,
we could slide back into a world where trade is just about raw power, you know, the strongest nations calling all the shots. Narlikar argues we have to understand the system's political flaws now if we want to avoid that kind of trade anarchy.
Okay, so let's talk about Amrita Narlikar herself, the source of these insights. She's a really distinguished scholar in international political economy, heads up the GIGA Institute in Germany now, but she spent years like laser focused on the WTO.
Yeah, her specialization is key. Her career has really been dedicated to the politics of the WTO. It's not just about the trade deals themselves. It's about power. Who holds it? How do they wield it? How do negotiations actually play out?
And crucially, she brings this non-Western perspective, right? As a scholar of Indian origin, that gives her real clarity on the persistent North-South divide.
Absolutely. When wealthy nations talk free trade, Narlikar helps us understand why developing countries often hear unequal rules. She examines the history, the context.
She explains why there are these grievances, how the rules were often shaped by just a few powerful players historically.
Exactly. And that legacy makes negotiating new rules for today's world incredibly difficult, almost impossible sometimes.
Which leads us right into her main argument, doesn't it? To grasp the WTO crisis, you can't just look at free trade theory. You have to dive into the national interests, the power struggles, the history.
Yeah, she says the WTO acts like a mirror, a geopolitical mirror. It reflects what's happening globally, the rise of China, India, those deep North-South tensions, the recent surge in nationalism.
So the problems we see playing out in Geneva, they aren't really caused by the WTO itself.
No, they're symptoms. The WTO is just where these global pressures become really visible.
And then there's the paradox she highlights. The WTO is essential, right? It's the only global system we have to prevent trade chaos. It offers stability, predictability. That's vital, especially for smaller economies.
Totally vital. But at the same time, it's kind of ineffective at its main legislative job. Making new rules for the 21st century. Think about e-commerce, climate change stuff.
So it's hailed as this pillar of stability, but also slammed as like a threat to national sovereignty. It's confusing.
And her goal is to unpack that. Why does this necessary system seem so stuck, so unable to fix its own problems?
Okay, let's get into the basics then. If the WTO is like this huge contract between countries, what are the absolute ground rules?
Well, the whole thing is built on non-discrimination. Basically, you can't play favorites. And that rests on two really simple but kind of revolutionary pillars. First one is most favored nation, MFN.
Ah, yes, the don't play favorites rule. So if you give one country, say Brazil, a special trade deal,
you have to immediately give that exact same deal to every single other WTO member, automatically. No conditions. It forces this universal treatment.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah.
What's the second pillar?
National treatment. Also sounds simple. Once a foreign product is legally in your country, tariff paid and all that.
You have to treat it exactly like a domestic product.
Exactly. You can't suddenly slap a special tax just on imported cars, for example, if local cars don't pay it.
Got it. So MFN and national treatment create the level playing field, theoretically. Mm-hmm. And the big agreements like GATT for goods, GATS for services, they build on that.
Right. And then there's TRIPS, the one for intellectual property. That one's often pretty controversial.
Especially with things like essential medicines, right? Pitting patent protection against public health needs in poorer countries.
Precisely. That's where the tension gets really sharp. It forces this clash between innovation incentives and access.
Okay, so there are rules, but rules need enforcing. That's where the WTO was a big step up from the old system, the GATT-CT. You're talking about the dispute settlement body, the DSB?
Yes, the DSB, often called the WTO's crown jewel. It was meant to replace raw economic power with the rule of law in trade disputes.
So if a country breaks a rule,
another country can bring a case. And if they win, the rule breaker has to change its law or face authorized trade sanctions like tariffs on their exports. It gives even small countries a way to challenge the big players.
And it worked, didn't it? I remember reading about cases like the US-EU banana wars.
Yeah.
Super complex. Went on for ages.
Yeah, a classic example. The DSB managed to rule on it. And both the US and EU, these massive blocs, eventually had to comply. It showed the system could actually work. It had teeth.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
Yeah.
This brings us back to the crisis Nirlikar talks about.
Right. Here's the scary part. The WTO's highest court, the appellate body, it's basically paralyzed right now.
Paralyzed? How does a court get paralyzed?
Because the U.S., under several administrations now, has systematically blocked the appointment of new judges.
Yeah.
You need consensus to appoint them, and the U.S. just said no.
So no new judges means?
It means the appellate body can't hear appeals. It can't issue final binding rulings on new disputes. The whole top layer of the enforcement system is effectively broken.
Wow. So if the most powerful member just decides to kind of ignore the core mechanism,
the whole rule of law structure for trade starts to crumble. It feels like an existential threat to the system.
And that really underlines Nirlikar's main point, doesn't it? The WTO is fundamentally political. It was never truly a level playing field.
Never. In the early days, it was dominated by the Quad, US, EU, Japan, Canada. They called the shots.
But developing countries didn't just sit back. Nirlikar talks about how they learned to organize, right?
Absolutely. They learned to build coalitions, really effective ones. It allowed them to, as she puts it, punch above their weight. The big example is the G20 group led by Brazil, India, China, especially on agriculture issues.
Yeah.
They became a serious force.
That must have caused a lot of friction. Where did these political deals actually get hammered out? Was it all formal meetings?
Oh, not always. A lot of the real dealing happened behind closed doors in the infamous green room.
The green room sounds exclusive.
It is. Informal meetings. Just the powerful countries or key coalitions invited. They'd stitch up a deal there and then present it to the rest of the members. It's pure political hardball, and it kind of undermines any claim the WTO has to being democratic.
And the ultimate example of this political gridlock, this breakdown, has to be the Doha Development Agenda, right? Launched way back in 2001.
Yeah, Doha. It was supposed to be the round focused on developing countries' needs, the development round.
But it just fizzled. Went nowhere for 20 years.
Spectacularly failed, really. Why? Because the core issues were just political dynamite. Developing countries wanted the US and EU to cut their huge farm subsidies. That was a political non-starter back home for the US and EU.
And what did the developed countries want in return?
They wanted emerging economies like India and Brazil to slash tariffs on industrial goods, what they call non-agricultural market access.
And neither side would budge enough.
Pretty much. Nirlikar argues it wasn't just a technical failure. It was a fundamental clash of economic models, a complete breakdown of trust between the North and South. Doha's collapse basically marked the end of trying to do big, comprehensive trade deals for everyone.
Okay, so when we hear about trade wars and globalization debates, it's easy to get caught up in the headlines. But Nirlikar's work pushes us to see the deeper institutional reality. Let's maybe pull out three key takeaways.
Good idea. First, really internalize that the WTO is a political arena. Every negotiation, every dispute, it's drenched in power politics, leverage, national interest. That's what decides outcomes, not just economic theory.
So when you hear a politician talk about a trade deal, remember it's the result of political bargaining, not some pure economic calculation. The constraints are voluntary, the result's political.
Exactly. Second takeaway, the enduring North-South divide. This historical fault line is still absolutely central. It affects everything, patents, subsidies, you name it.
And that helps explain why other global talks, like on climate or health, often get bogged down too. It's the same underlying distrust.
Often, yes. That deep-seated divide reappears in new contexts. And third, that core paradox. The WTO is indispensable, yet ineffective.
Right. You can't really make new rules effectively anymore.
But it's the only global framework stopping outright trade chaos. It provides crucial stability, especially for smaller countries that don't have the muscle to dictate terms. Nirlikar frames the choice bluntly: it's imperfect rules or dangerous anarchy.
Her analysis offers some really powerful ways to think about this.
Yeah.
Maybe we can share a few key ideas, sort of like quotes, that capture her perspective.
Yeah, there are some great ones. Like this: the World Trade Organization is better understood not as a court or a bank, but as a perpetual political negotiation.
I like that.
Yeah.
It emphasizes that nothing's ever really settled. The rules are just the current state of play in an ongoing power struggle.
Mm-hmm. And this one, which feels very relevant right now given the DSB crisis: the dispute settlement body cannot survive when its most powerful member decides to ignore the rules.
Oof, that's pretty stark. A clear warning about the fragility of it all if major players walk away from multilateralism.
It really is. And finally, that central metaphor we talked about. For its fiercest critics, the WTO is a villain, and for its staunchest defenders, it is a hero. The reality is that it is a mirror. To blame the WTO for these issues is to blame the mirror for the reflection.
That's a call for more sophisticated thinking, isn't it? Stop just blaming the institution.
Right. Focus instead on the national policies, the protectionism, the subsidies that the WTO is simply reflecting back at us. The mirror isn't the problem. It's what the mirror shows.
So, thinking practically, how can we, use this understanding in everyday life?
Well, for one, as an informed citizen, you can listen much more critically when politicians talk about trade deals or whine about national sovereignty being undermined by the WTO.
Because you understand, these are voluntary agreements countries chose to sign, usually to get market access and stability in return.
Exactly. And if you're interested in global health, understanding the TRIPS agreement on intellectual property suddenly makes sense of why there are huge fights over generic drug prices in poorer nations. It connects abstract trade law to real lives.
Definitely. What about for people in business, entrepreneurs, supply chain managers?
For them, understanding the bedrock principles like MFN and national treatment is crucial. That's the predictability they rely on for market access. But Narlikar's work is also a huge warning sign about the risks they face if this system keeps eroding sudden tariffs, broken supply chains.
Looking back at this deep dive, what was most surprising or striking for you?
For me, I think it was really digging into the details of the developing country coalitions, like the G20, just how politically savvy and effective they became. They weren't just reacting, they learned how to actively shape and sometimes block the agenda. That's real power emerging.
Yeah, that's fascinating. My biggest takeaway, maybe the most urgent message from Narlikar, is just how critical reform is. The WTO is flawed, deeply political, sure, but it offers protections, especially for smaller nations, that simply wouldn't exist in a pure power-based free-for-all.
Its survival really depends on whether the members can finally adapt it to today's world, digital trade, climate, inequality. The choice seems pretty stark. Adapt the imperfect system we have, or risk a slide into global economic disorder. It's complex, contested, but maybe necessary.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.